We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the podcast. We probably just, well, I didn't watch because I'm a loser, but Michael probably just watched one of the most exciting Super Bowls of all time. And we're not coming on here to talk about that, though. We're coming on here to talk about the Pelicans. Because they're clearly as exciting as that Super Bowl game. Wouldn't you say clearly as exciting?
I mean, they might be as exciting as some of the commercials for that Super Bowl, which is probably one of the biggest commercial letdowns in Super Bowl history, but definitely not the game. Yeah. I mean, they do have something in common. I mean, the Falcons were up 28-3, and then the Patriots rolled off 25 straight points. We basically just saw that in the last Pelicans game with the Pelicans playing the role of the Falcons. So
yeah, I don't know if I can go quite that far. They definitely played that role, but the magnitudes were completely different. And I'm sure everybody in New Orleans is extremely happy right now to have the nemesis Falcons lose, though. I know everyone's conflicted all the time that it's the Patriots winning, but I don't know.
I like when you see like underprivileged people get, like, if Tom Brady loses that game, he only has 4 Super Bowls, a supermodel wife, and a couple $100 million. It's nice when you see good things finally happen to good people.
That's right. He finally got to triumph a little bit in his life.
Yeah, he deserves it.
Oh, God. Well, hey, at least the sports guy's happy right now, right? He needs a little pick-me-up. He's had a rough year.
Yeah, he has. I mean, at least his podcast hasn't been canceled yet. But, yeah, it would have been nice to see him go on and wallow for a little bit. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to that pod tomorrow after we do our own.
Right. So let's talk about our team. Because I don't want to jump right into the loss against Washington. You know, that was depressing enough on its own. But we did have some fun. I mean, so just since the last podcast, I can speak. The team went 2-5, and I was thinking that next podcast I was going to have with you, we were going to get on, and you were going to be like, "They just ruined everything, man," because we started off so well. Like, we won against Cleveland, then we went and beat San Antonio, and you know, it was like, it felt like, you know, maybe they're going to at least pull off a 500 or better than 500 until the next podcast, and then they crapped the bed. So
yeah, and I before we did say we looked at these seven games, and we said the most likely outcome was 1-6. That this team playing those seven games, 1-6 was the most likely outcome. They go 2-5, and of course, the two wins are against the very likely Eastern Conference champion and probably one of the only two teams that could win the Western Conference championship. So, of course, those would be the two games they got wins in. But, I mean, they played really well. They had a huge lead at halftime against Toronto, and it took a miracle shot by Kyle Lowry for Toronto to beat them. I really felt like the only game that they didn't really seem to have much of a chance in, whereas I'm watching it, I go, yeah, they're not going to win this game. The only game I really felt that about in this stretch was Oklahoma City. I don't know what it is. It's like they just don't really have an answer for Westbrook. And, you know, Oklahoma City doesn't really offer a lot of, offer a lot on defense that the Pelicans can't seem to overcome. They just never have one of those games where somebody gets crazy hot against them. Meanwhile, somebody like Alex Abrines or whatever will go off against us. But I felt like they could have theoretically won every other game. Even that Pistons game that they lost by 20,
yeah. That
just got away late. But there was points in that game where I felt like they were the better team. So it's just such a weird team to watch, because you watch them in almost any game and there's points where you're like, okay, they're a good team. They're the better team on the court. And then for some reason, some stretch, it could be in the third, fourth quarter, the fourth, whatever, some stretch will just completely take them out of the game.
Yeah, so I've actually been trying to pinpoint that more and more, because it does feel like, you know, remember when like Byron Scott was our coach and the Hornets would just torch everybody in the first two quarters of that game. And then the third quarter would come along, and Byron Scott would just get out coached, and it would take him like an entire quarter to figure out, hey, they're doing something different. Maybe ask Chris Paul what's going on, have Chris Paul explain it to him. It feels a little bit like that. Like there's at different points in the game, the other team just figures out, well, this is the one thing that's really working for these guys. And if they could take that one thing away, the Pelicans are kind of done. And it feels like they're figuring, like teams figure that out at some point in the game, and then they go on a crazy run. And it usually has to do with just figuring out how to make Drew actually have to like become a jump shooter. If you can make Drew into a jump shooter, they're pretty much done for creation. Because Tyreek Evans, he might be able to get to the basket, but he's just not good anymore. He's just not a good player anymore. So. It's really, if you can make Drew into a jump shooter, this team, sure, they're going to get buckets every once in a while by getting the ball to Davis, but they're not going to get him often, and they're not going to get him efficiently, and it just feels like that's the one counter you have to be able to throw at him, and we have no counterpunch for it. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think the other part is what I've been saying for I don't know how many years now, is when I watch other teams start to struggle and miss their shots, they do one of two things. They get cheap points / fast break points, or more likely, they get to the free throw line. Like the other night, I know Houston wound up losing because Hardaway Jr. went crazy, but I'm looking at that Houston-Atlanta game, and Houston is shooting even worse than we do in our worst game. I mean, they're just missing everything. They took close to 50 threes, and I think they might have made like 11. Like, it was bad. But then I look at their free throw attempts, and they were close to 40. And Harden had like 20 of them. And it's teams are going to be off, but when Golden State is off from beyond beyond the arc, they're running, they're getting cheap points on putbacks, they're getting to the free throw line. It's just, if this team is not making their jump shots, are they going to hit the offensive glass and get points that way? We know the answer is no, because they don't even pound the offensive glass. Are they going to get to the line? Anthony Davis is the only person on this team that gets to the line at above average rate. Nobody else is even close. Do you even know who's second on this team in free throw attempts per game?
No. So let me think and guess. I will probably go with Etuan Moore. Oh, or it could be Terrence Jones.
It's Terrence Jones who's shooting 60%.
Right.
So, yay, he gets there, but then he goes one of two. So, like, where do you get these other points when your shots are off? So it's so dependent. And then, if you know, they'll have the games like against Cleveland where Galloway can't miss and then other, you know, where Moore can't miss. And then in those games, if it sustains for all four quarters, they're fine, but what winds up happening more likely than not is that's a one or a two quarter thing, and then all of a sudden that stops. They're not crashing the glass. I mean, I just don't know how that's a recipe for success. If you know your team doesn't get to the line, why wouldn't you crash the glass or just try to force fast breaks as much as you can? This team doesn't do any of those three. So how else in the world are they supposed to score, especially, you know, when they're cold from the outside?
Yeah, well, I mean, so we know they don't do the offensive glass, like you said. And by the way, they still are on pace to be historically low offensive rebound rate. Like, I think Boston holds the record at like 19, and they're still at like 16.5 or so. So they are kicking the crap out of the previous low. But if you just think about this team in general, like, is there anybody on this team that you think would actually be aggressive off of a made basket blitzing down the floor? Is there any player on this team who you think would do that?
I mean, the only one that was on this team this whole year would be Lance Stephenson.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's that type of moronically out of control, but that you need sometimes. But yeah, no, nobody on the current team. I would say the guy who pushes the ball most off of a May on the current team is Solomon Hill, which is just all kinds of scary.
That's right, because he's terrifying. And they, like, every time he starts dribbling, I get a tight fist in my stomach.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just frustrating. It's like, people get all excited because we play at a pretty good pace. We're seventh in the league right now. But all we're doing is increasing the number of possessions in the game. So both teams have possessions, but we know we're not going to crash the glass. We know we're not going to get to the free throw line. So why do we want to have all of these possessions in a game when really we're relying on the, you know, the highest variance or most volatile shot in the game, and we don't even shoot it that well? Like, I guess I'm more surprised sometimes that this team has 19 wins than that they have 32 losses, because there's not really many, if any, bad team. I mean, isn't Brooklyn the only bad team in the NBA right now?
I would say Phoenix is probably, and the Lakers are probably in there too.
I mean, Phoenix could get – Phoenix's backcourt is unbelievable. I mean, they've been playing great right now. But, yeah, I mean, they're not good. I guess when I say bad,
I mean
awful?
Like, if you lose to them, you should be embarrassed. And if you lose to them by 30, you should just quit playing.
Yeah, I mean, in years past, we had all the Philly teams. We had that New York team that was 17-65. This Lakers team is bad, but it's not as bad as like the last 2 years, you know, with Kobe.
Yeah.
So, so you're playing all these teams that could beat you on any given night. You're increasing the possessions, and then you're basically saying, well, we better hope that we're hot from outside because there's no other way that we're going to really get points. I don't understand how that's a possible formula for victory. I think they would have to do at least one of the other two. Go out, go all out and crash the boards, or, you know, just try to get to the line, which I'm surprised they can't do with as much space as they have. That was always Eric Gordon's theory, is that if this team spaced out, then they'd be able to drive more and the refs would be able to see the contact and they'd get to the line. But, like, how has Drew Holiday been this good and he's still not getting to the free throw line?
You got me. I will say Drew does tend to try to finesse things more than go through people. But he does get hit a lot and the calls never come his way. And it's always because he's usually being hit in such a way that he's more being deflected than having his arms hacked, I guess. He doesn't have the knack of drawing free throws, that's for sure. He needs to watch some tape of James Harden and, like, just go sit on some dude's back for a while. And did you see that Harden did that again?
Yeah, that's a good old trend for him. But so in the last five games, Holiday's usage is through the roof, putting up 23-9 a game. I mean, I hate when we just talk about stats. I'm just talking about eye test. This is the best I've ever seen Drew Holiday play.
Very aggressive.
Yeah, I don't care. I mean, the ball goes in or misses by an inch. Like, that doesn't tell me you're much better or worse. The way he is playing to me is fantastic. That being said, in the last five games, and we're talking about a guy who's playing 38 minutes a game, he's only averaging 2 free throw attempts a game. Like, how is that possible for a guard with the ball in his hands that much, that high of usage, taking that many field goal attempts? I mean, we're talking about averaging 18 field goal attempts a game. How does that happen? Like, if he's not getting to the line now, he never, ever will.
No, he won't. But he's never had in his entire career. Like, that's the thing with Drew. Like, he's always been... he takes shots in such a way that he's not getting hit. Like, it's just.
Do you think? But what is it? Is it an intelligence thing? Like, if you put James Harden's brain in Drew Holiday's body, does he get to the line more, or is it a type of athleticism thing where Harden's more herky jerky and, you know, Drew's more straight line? Like, what would you say is the number one thing you would have to change about Drew to get him to the line more? Would you have to change his athleticism, his brain? What would it have to be?
You would have to convince him that rather than try to take a flip shot if someone's near you, go through them and absorb the pain.
So you say convince him. So one, do you think anybody's ever told him that?
Don't get me wrong. I don't think Drew's doing anything necessarily wrong. And yes, we want him to draw free throws, but what he's trying to do is get himself a clean shot. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that either. Like, it's one of those things where are you going to try to go through the guy and maybe not even get a good shot and not get a good call? Or if you think you can manufacture a clean shot, take it. My problem is he's not the greatest shot maker around the rim. So he's always trying to make these clean shots, but then he misses as it dribbles off the side. But I really do think, like, I don't see Harden gets his points from the free throw line by powering through people and purposely driving into them and purposely throwing his arms through them as they go after the ball and throwing his head back like he's just been slapped across the face. And Drew doesn't do any of that. Like, if somebody's near him, he'll take a step back and put it in, or he'll try to do an up fake and spin and make like a floater over them. He's not going to go through them at all.
But okay, so Harden's the exception. So he's not going to be Harden. I'm not even asking him. But yep. John Wall gets to the line 6 times a game.
Yeah.
Like, that would make me ecstatic for Drew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like he's doing all these weird whatever things. And there's other guards. I don't need him to get to the line 10, 12 times, but I don't think it's ridiculous to say 5 or 6. And I'm just trying to figure out why some guys with similar bodies, similar skill sets get there. Like, it's just got to be some kind of a mental thing. I don't think he's afraid of the contact, but anyway, I think we could safely say that Drew's not going to become that guy. But you know, you see the record 19-32, and you've been through all these losses, but I don't know. Am I crazy? I just don't feel like, this team is terrible, and it would take a lot to over. I mean, we're still talking about a team with a minus 3 point differential. So if they score one extra point in each quarter, then all of a sudden they're what are they? They're a 27 and 24 type of team. Like, am I crazy not to think that this team, I guess, is just as bad? When I see a 19-32 record, I'm like, oh, that team must be terrible. I feel like this team is just, nah. And if you take Solomon Hill out and you put in who's an above average, you put Nicholas Batum from last year in Solomon Hill's spot, like, this is probably a 5 or a 6 seed. Am I crazy, or do you see some of those things too?
I don't know if I could squint that hard and think they'd be a 5 or 6 seed. I know where you're going, and it feels like they have some of the right pieces. Because, like, early in the season, we were sitting here saying, this is just, this team can't shoot. They're just a bad shooting team. I don't feel that way anymore. Do you feel like that's still the case?
I feel no.
Like we've got a couple sharpshooters actually on this team that get minutes.
Yeah, we just don't supplement them when they go cold with, you know, something.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I can sort of squint and see what you're saying. Like, it feels like there are the right pieces that you could mix and match, and if you added an ingredient, suddenly you've got a decent team. But I and this is probably the hardest thing to say, I think Anthony Davis needs some real help for him to be able to carry this team to that kind of level. He's just carrying way too much of a load, and you have to bring in a guy who can be a volume, moderately efficient guy to supplement him. And that to me is more than just like, hey, bring in a decent Nick Batum. I really feel like just Davis, he just looks like he's been the crap beat out of him at this point.
Yeah.
And so you have to start like in the, if this was my world and I was building the team the way I wanted to, I would have a team that would allow him to play only 32 minutes a game and have some nights where he could only play 30 and he just doesn't have to take all that pounding, which means you have to have some big men on the team who aren't garbage and you're not spending $16 million on two guys who can't play a minute in the game. He's got to have that. And so I can't quite get there. It's more than just a little piece. But you're right. I mean, if you could find a one other scorer next to Drew, I think that's letting up enough of the pressure that maybe Davis wouldn't have to be worn down so much by this point.
Yeah. See, I think that first month and a half, absolutely killed Anthony Davis, and we're seeing the effects of it now. Because if you had the Anthony Davis beginning of the year and this Drew Holiday, those two guys alone with a bunch of D-League All-Stars would make you a 600% win team. Like, the way Drew is playing now, but now by the time Drew has finally found his groove, Anthony Davis is just exhausted and beat up and probably has 5 little injuries. I mean, what does he have now? He has the thigh. His finger was his thumb on his left.
His thumb, yeah.
Like, he's got all these little banged up things and, you know, he's just carrying such a heavy load. And then also think about his mentality. I mean, in those games, his usage rate was like 35%. They were telling him to shoot everything. Now he's got some help back, and you could see it's taken him a while to adjust to the, oh, I could actually kick it out, and these guys are going to make a shot. So he's had to readjust to that. But if you took beginning of the year Anthony Davis and this Drew Holiday, I this team would be fantastic, but I don't know if you're going to get that beginning of the year Anthony Davis again for the rest of the year. Maybe right after the All-Star break, but he just looks so beat up. So
are you like, let's say next year, Drew Holiday is healthy to begin the season, and he comes back and he's a Pelican. They've added some guy in the draft who's going to be Buddy Hield-ish or maybe a little bit better. And Anthony Davis is there, and they've brought in another wing shooter. Just a shooter, not like a really offensive-minded slasher or anything. Do you think that Drew and Anthony Davis are going to, if they're both there at the beginning and they're both at full speed, are going to be able to propel this team to a playoff berth?
Not only that, but you would have your guy next to Anthony Davis from day one. I mean, they started off this year with Ajinsa and Ashik.
It matters.
Yeah, and now they're trying to go and in the middle of the season play the small ball while also incorporating guys like Tyreek coming back. And, you know, they're like juggling so much. But, yeah, you would have that. You would have, I mean, I remember on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, I said Etuan Moore is just going to get better and better the longer he's here and in the system. I think he's going to continue to get better. I think Buddy will be better by next year. I think he takes – so it would be all of those factors that, yeah, and then maybe you add one more guy. But I guess I just feel like the NBA right now is like 2 to 4 elite teams at the top. Then you have another little group below that of like 4 or 5, you know, good teams. And then you've got like this middle of 20 and then one terrible team in Brooklyn. But I really don't think going from the 26th best team to the 11th best team, I don't even think that's as big of a job. I think that's like a, you know, that's one extra made three in the first half and a two in the second half of a 5-point little swing. And all of a sudden you go from the 26th, 27th best team to the 10th or 11th. I think there's so much parity in the middle. I think somebody's making that jump next year. Minnesota, New Orleans, Milwaukee, somebody's going from that bottom rung to 4th, 5th seed. So yeah, I don't think it's nuts. And when you see some of these games that they compete in, I mean, they're up 91-90, 42 minutes into the game. They played 42 minutes toe-to-toe with by far the hottest team in the NBA, especially at home.
Yeah.
At the end of a road trip, they go toe-to-toe for 42 minutes, and then they just get wiped off the floor in the final six. But that just tells me it's not like we're talking about a terrible team. We're talking about a team with a terrible record, but it's a team that's not far away from being respectable, I guess, is what I came away from these last 7 games.
Okay. Well, that's a lot more positive than you've been in the past. So I got a question on Twitter, and I kind of want to morph it into like a greater thing. But the question was essentially, Anthony Davis doesn't really set screens anymore. He pretty much always slips them. So the guy that you put next to him, does it have to be someone who can set bone-jarring screens? Are you looking for a big bruiser kind of guy? What if I told you right now you could have any big man in the league that's not like a top-tier star and put him next to Anthony Davis? Who are you picking? Like, who would you gun for?
You know, I watching that Washington game, I would not mind Gortat. I mean, you're talking, okay. He could rebound. He's not an embarrassment when he guards in space. He sets picks. He has a nice enough little shooting touch. He could go down low. He could post D. I mean, that's not a guy I think anybody ever mentions when they talk about the top tier big men. You know, supposedly Phoenix ripped off Washington when they got a first a couple of years ago. I think Washington makes that trade 100 out of 100 times still. A guy like that would be – I'd be more than happy with. That said, you know, I don't know how many guys are like that out there, but that would be if I had a non-star center, I would mm-hmm. take that over a Vucevic. You know, Steven Adams would be nice, but I think most consider him on a slightly – higher tier than Gortat, but yeah, I mean, give me, I think the key is that you got to have. Obviously, you want a guy who's physical and rebound, but in that 16 to 18 foot area on both sides, offense and defense, you want a big who's respectable. You want him to at least be able to bury that jumper occasionally, and then on defense, you want him to show or, you know, at least get into a defensive stance out there and not just be a stiff board like a Sheik or a Jinsa. So a guy like Gortat would make me happy. How about you?
Yeah, I was struggling with it. I was, like, looking around. At first I started with, well, who would be available, and I was coming up with names like Costa Koufos and things like that, which they're just not really the answer. I actually settled on, I wanted to get your opinion. We talked about this when we watched the, I guess it was not the Olympics, but the World Games. If they got Fareed, do you think that would be a good combination with Davis?
No, because I don't think people respect, I mean, I don't think they respect
have a jumper.
Jumper, and I still think that Davis would be left, you know, defending in the post against the bigger guy. I mean, you want to know my, this is sad, you want to know my dream combo going in next year at center?
Go ahead.
Donatas Montiejunas and Joffrey Lavernay.
Really, Joffrey?
Yeah.
I haven't watched him enough to get that excited about him.
I mean, he's 7 foot. He's only like probably 230. He's not, you know, big enough, but whatever. I let him get beat up down there. But he could actually rebound. He's respectable from up to three. You know, you look at his stat, he's not great, but I would gladly spend $15 million combined on Demo and Joffrey next year. That would be a nice little, I mean, it's kind of a new age when Duncan had the Rasho Nesterovic's of the world and whatever, but I just go get me
Nazi Muhammad, Rasho, yeah. He always had that kind of guy.
Yeah, but it's new age because they have an outside game, whatever, but they're not great, but they're going to do the little things for you. That would be my hope. I would love to trade, just get rid of Terrence Jones, give Demo some more time this year, and then go get King Joffrey. And just have those two guys just eat up minutes next to Anthony Davis while hopefully we go get another guard or wing. But yeah, he's a guy, if you get a chance when Oklahoma City's playing, just watch him and see how you think he fit, because I don't think they're going to be able to afford him next year, and they already have so many bigs, but he's the guy that would be at the top of my free agent list next year. Just sign him, Joffrey, Drew, and then go draft the stud in the draft. I'm not being too picky.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing I thought about, so I wanted to bring this up too, because he did ask, like, does it bother you that Davis doesn't set solid screens anymore? Do you think it's a function of the fact he's getting beat up all the time? Do you think it's just he's supposed to do that, or do you think he actually doesn't want to set a screen?
I remember at the beginning of the year he was.
Uh-huh.
I think as you keep losing, like, we all say, well, the guy's making $20 million a year, suck it up and play hard every minute. I think losing just wears on you. And I think if he was just as tired right now, but they were 32 and 19, he'd be sprinting up the floor. He'd be setting picks. I think it just kind of weighs on you, and I don't think this is an absolute thing that we come to expect for the rest of his career. I think this is the effects of losing, and it weighs on a guy, and you start doing the little things less and less as you're losing. As you know, I know that would make people upset because the guy's making so much money, but I think that's the reality, because I remember at the beginning of the year, I remember thinking that he was setting more and better screens than I had ever seen.
Yeah. And I mean, I will also say that while I do agree that there are moments where he's not really setting screens and he's just looking to slide to a pop spot, there are moments where, like, he will set solid screens, especially if he's running, like, a two-man game with Drew. He will rub people hard and get them off of Drew. He does a pretty good job of that. So I think he's just picking his spots more often than he used to. I think he doesn't really try for Tyreke Evans, to be honest. I think after you try to set for a screen for Tyreek Evans five times in a row and he goes away from the pick, four of them, you're probably like, yeah, whatever.
Have you ever seen the movie Along Came Polly?
No.
I just want you to go on YouTube or something after this podcast and it's just a minute long, but I want you to watch the basketball scenes with Philip Seymour Hoffman and tell me if you don't think that he's doing his impersonation of Tyreek Evans in that movie. I've never seen anybody drive to the basket with such grace at times and miss a layup with so little touch.
Yeah.
I mean, he drives to the basket. It looks beautiful. And then it looks like he's just trying to break the backboard. I would bet that he leads the league in number of layup attempts missed without hitting the rim. I have no doubt in my mind. I watch a lot of basketball. I don't see anybody else do it. And I could just count. I would bet in the last seven games, there was at least 10 times he drove to the rim, shot a layup, and it didn't even hit the rim. It just came off the backboard. Watch it. Along Came Polly, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Just watch it. Tell me that's not Tyreek.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Tyreek, like I said it earlier, I think he's just bad now. Because even when he first joined the Pelicans, he would still go to the basket, and yes, his finishing rates were not high, but they weren't garbage. They were okay. And now they're garbage. When he goes for a layup, I expect him to miss it. So.
Yeah, I definitely don't expect him to get fouled and go to the line.
Why would you bother?
Yeah, no, I mean, to me, I think his best offensive weapon now, the shot that I think is going in more than any other, is the wing three.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a team that there's some pieces on here that I could kind of see. Like I said, I'm excited about more. Buddy, I think is going to be a solid, but there's some things you just see with the lack of the first step and the lack of the explosiveness and creativity at the rim. Like, I think if you're being really honest with yourself, it's hard to see him ever being a star. Like, it's tough to picture that. I don't know what that path would look like, but I still think you're going to have a solid rotation player that could light it up on some nights. I like Demo. I guess that's what I want to get your opinion of. I want you to explain to me, because I see Terrence Jones play and I see Donatas Montaginus play, and yeah, I get that Jones could get the buckets and, you know, he gets the exciting blocks. Like, the block of LeBron James might be,
yeah,
when we look at the Pelicans highlight reel from this season, that might be number one.
It was awesome.
So I get that, but to me, overall, it's so clear that if you took the same four guys and put Donatas on it, and the same four guys and put Terrence Jones on it, and just had that team simulate a season, to me it's clear that the team with Montaginus on it would be the better team. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Convince me otherwise. Try to take me through either your mind, if you disagree with me, or the Pelicans coaches' minds, whatever, and explain to me why Jones is getting all these minutes and Montaginus is just, he isn't.
So I 100% believe this is what the coaches are thinking, as well as my own thought about it. And it's also why I don't necessarily agree with your previous statement about take the same guys and put Montaginus and take the same guys and put Terrence Jones and Montaginus' team would win. It's all need. And I believe that Terrence Jones is a scorer. The guy is capable of scoring on his own. He's not always good at it. He's a lower-tier scorer. But he can manufacture shots on his own or on the move. And he's got a lot of different junk in the trunk around the rim. He's actually a pretty solid scorer. Montaginus, I don't see him like that. I think he is a brilliant facilitator and ball mover. and he makes the right play more often than he makes the wrong play, and he tries hard on defense. But if your team desperately needs a bucket, and that's what they're doing with Jones in the second unit, is basically just saying, Jones, you run it unless Tyreek's on the floor. And then if you happen to have him pass it to you, which will happen once out of every 15 possessions, then you can score. He is basically, you know, the Jamal Crawford of big men to me. That is his job, and he's not bad at it. But if I was talking about like a team that has a good version of Tyreek Evans out there, or Drew's on the floor, or Davis is on the floor, I would infinitely prefer to have Donatas Montajunas out there with them.
Oh, I totally agree. Like, Terrence Jones puts up godlike stats when Anthony Davis is out. So I totally agree. If you're talking about a second unit big that's just out there to get buckets with a bunch of other guys, I get that with Terrence Jones. But what I'm seeing is Terrence Jones playing a majority of his minutes with Davis. Like, to me, if I was trying to win games, and they are, even though I wish they weren't, to me, the clear solution is you start Montajunas and you play him mostly with Davis, and then when Davis was out, Terrence Jones would just be, like you said, the big man version of Jamal Crawford, and he's getting you buckets to keep you in the game. I just think a team with Montajunas on it moves the ball so much better and gets so many better shots for the other four guys. So that's what I'm saying. I don't get why Montajunas isn't playing. I mean, I think you clearly start him and then bring Jones off the bench and just give him the green light. But
so that was where I was going to go with my question for you next. So Alvin Gentry is fired tomorrow, and they call out Michael McNamara and say, "You're the coach. We know you don't want to take over this team, but we're going to pay you millions of dollars to take over this team." What you walk in there? What is your starting lineup the next day? And who's your first guy off the bench, second guy off the bench, third guy off the bench? What's your eight man?
And I'm trying to win.
You're trying to win.
Okay.
They tell you that you'll even get a millions of dollars extra if you win more games than you lose.
Okay, I would probably start Drew, Moore, Buddy, AD, and Demo.
Okay.
Because people will be like, well, you can't go even smaller on the wing and backcourt if, you know, you're already going small up front with Demo, to which I would counter, the only reason you would want a traditional quote-unquote small forward is if that guy could help you rebound, and he can't. So, I mean, with those guys, I have the best shooting, the best ball movement, you know, hardworking guys. I got two guys who could pressure the ball on the wings, and Moore and Drew. I mean, to me, that's my starting lineup. And then my rotation, I would have Hill. I would probably go nine. I would have Hill, Tyreek, Galloway, and Jones kind of as my other four. Dante wouldn't be in my regular rotation, but I guess if I had to go 10, I'd put him. But those would be my main nine guys.
I'm appalled that you don't have Jensen in there.
Don't have who?
Ajinsa.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, I look at him as, and Ashik as not even being on the team anymore. Frazier, I wish they could get minutes for, but I just don't see how you do when everybody's healthy. But yeah, that would be my main nine. So I'd probably, first thing I would do is probably sub out Buddy and either bring in Hill or Tyreek, depending on the matchup and what I needed right there. Then I'd probably take out Montajunas and put in Jones in more of a secondary role, and then I take out AD, and then Jones becomes more of a shooter. But that would be my rotation. How about you? What's your starting lineup?
So my starting lineup was actually going to be Holiday, Heald, Hill, Montajunas, and Davis. And so I think you have to have Hill be in there when Drew and Davis are both in there. I think that's the only time he's viable, when there are two guys who legitimately can be threats and get him the ball for his open threes that he can still knock down at a mediocre rate, which is fine. Like, that's the one thing he can do for you offensively. So I would have Hill be in there. As soon as Drew or Davis are walking out, Hill is going off the floor, and he doesn't come back on the floor until both of them are back on it. But other than that, yeah, I think I'd go the same way route you would. I'm really close, though, at this point of just saying goodbye Tyreek and having Frazier take his minutes. I'm that close.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for Frazier. I think he really came in and tried to keep this team's head above water when there was nobody here, and I wish, and even Galloway starting to get DNPs or low minutes, like, I wish those guys would either be moved on or some minutes would be open up for him. But that being said, I kind of like the fact that these coaches maybe unknowingly are self-sabotaging themselves, because I don't know how you root for wins at this point. Like, I don't see what good they could do when we're so bunched up in the standings. I mean, we talk about that San Antonio and that Cleveland game and how it was kind of a fluke that they won those games. If they lose those games right now, they're right there tied for the third worst record in the NBA. Like, they have a legit shot at a bottom three record. I mean, Phoenix has even been somewhat respectable lately. It's not insane that this team could finish with a bottom two, bottom three record. And meanwhile, if you go on a little mini winning streak, I mean, let's say the Pelicans go on a little 5-1 streak, then they're all the way up at like the 12th or 13th pick. I don't get how you root for wins at this point right now. And it's, I don't know, make the argument. Can you make the argument for me? Why should, when I put on this Pelicans game tomorrow night against Phoenix, be hoping that they win the game?
Because it's fun to watch your team win.
Even when
that's all,
you know,
that's all instant gratification. Forget about next year.
See, I disagree. Like, let's imagine that we were watching some kind of a horse race, and the horse I loved was racing, and I knew that the winner of this horse race got sacrificed to the gods. Would it be fun for me to watch my horse win?
Well, don't even think about that. Just think that this is a tournament game. They win, or they go home. Just think of it that way. And then you can even have more fun, because then you can look at the schedule and see another game coming up and be surprised. It's like, wow, they have another game. This is exciting. And you can be excited every time they play.
Yeah, I can't trick myself into doing that. Sorry.
You could be like that guy on that movie Memento. Be like him. Like, every time you get a surprise.
Yeah, I don't think he actually has that condition, but that's for another podcast altogether. I think that there's many clues in that movie that he doesn't actually have that condition.
It was a very good movie.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's been in my top three for years.
Wow. I have it in the top 10, but...
Memento, Goodwill Hunting, Fight Club... been my top three for years, Casablanca a close fourth. But So I should root, you're telling me I should root for the Pelicans to beat the Suns when I watch tomorrow night.
Sure.
Okay. So
look, I'm in the same place you are at this point. Like, there, and actually I want to take this one step further. In your heart of hearts, do the Pelicans have to try to be in the conversation for a top six pick? Like, do they have to decide they're going to, like, have Anthony Davis start sitting out games for rest, or they have to actually, you know, shut down a guy on their team for them to be a team with a poor record? Or do you think that's just going to come naturally?
I don't, because I really do think that even with as bad as this team is, they're a 500 team with Anthony Davis and Drew. their record looks so bad because of how it started out and with Drew missing all those games. I mean, they started off 1-9 and then he missed, you know, other games on the back to back or whatever, but they started off 1-9. So since then they're what, 18-23. So they're close to a five. And if they play that way the rest of the year, so let's see, they have 31 games left. So say they go 14-17, like, yeah, 33 wins, that's not going to get them a top six pick. And I think that's the thing that's actually been frustrating me the most, is that even as they're losing these games, like freaking Minnesota last night, who has 19 wins also, they play Memphis at home. Memphis sits out like Gasol, Tony Allen, and one other player, and Minnesota can't even beat them. Like, there's other teams there that I think are going to struggle. I think Sacramento, with Rudy Gay being out, like, I think they're going to struggle to keep winning games, and they're probably even incentivized to lose because otherwise their pick goes to Chicago. So I think that you got to probably finish, what did you say, to get a top six pick? I think you'd have to finish with 28 wins or less. I think this team with Drew and AD is going to win at least 10 more games. So yeah, I think that they've actively got to do some things to finish there. And if they really actively do things, I do think a bottom three record is even in play. And with this draft, I see three guys that I would be ecstatic if we got, a fourth that I think would be very good. And then, yeah, there's a couple after that, but I think landing a top three pick in this draft could be a game changer on the level of landing a number one pick in the last couple drafts. Like, I think the top three guys in this draft, I would rather have all of them over Ben Simmons and Brandon Ingram, and over guys like Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker. Even though those guys are good, I would take my top three in this coming draft over all those guys I mentioned. I would take them over all of the guys who have been top picks in the last couple of years, other than Karl-Anthony Towns. So
just so you say it now, because I'm interested to see how it transforms with the rest of the college. Who are your top three right now? Because I thought you had Ball out of it.
I do, Jackson. Yeah. I have Fultz, Dennis Smith, and then Jackson from Kansas, but Ball is my fourth guy that I would be very happy with. I think he's going to need the right and perfect system, and I think that this situation is a little toxic and they might not be patient with him. I think he really is going to, like, if that guy, and there's got to be other organizations like this, but if that guy went to San Antonio, he might be one of the greatest players of all time. I don't know if I trust this organization to be patient with them. And the other thing a top three pick could get you, because I still don't know if this team's going to take a 19-year-old. I'd still be shocked. But a top three pick gets you Jimmy Butler in a trade, where the 6th, 7th, 8th pick, like, you're probably walking away with Damari Carroll and Norman Powell.
Right.
Like, honestly, if you put one on the market versus the other, I really think you could walk away with a Jimmy Butler. If you get a top 1, 2, maybe even third pick, you get that 7th or 8th pick, like, and you want to try to trade it for your young vet as normal, you're going to get like the Mike Miller, Randy Foy deal. So that's why I think it's that important to land there. So
let me ask you one question here, because you talked about being a seller, basically if making some moves. And again, I don't think they're going to. I really don't think they're going to. Even if they lose every single game up to the trade or the All-Star game, I don't see the Pelicans selling assets, and it burns me up that I don't see them doing that. But let's say they did. I look at the league right now, and it only feels like there's like one team that you could maybe take advantage of to get like draft considerations or something like that for an established veteran. and that's the Orlando Magic. Can you think of any other team that's going to be like, yeah, we'll give you whatever you want, the first round pick this coming year, we'll give you this plus the salary filler for your mediocre veteran, because we need help of any sort.
Do you think if you went to Denver and you offered them, say, Tyreek and Terrence Jones, and then the best of your 2 second-round picks, so you guarantee them whichever one's the best, let's say that pick will be around 34 or 35, you offer them that, for they have the rights to Memphis's pick, which should be like 21, 22, 23. And now they get Tyreek. They could just give Jameer Nelson over to Cleveland, who wants him. Now they put Tyreek in that spot. They get Terrence Jones coming off the bench to give them some minutes. And then they're basically dropping down 14, 15 spots in the draft, and it's a non-guaranteed contract, and they already have enough young guys. Do you think a trade like that is insane?
I don't think it's insane, but for some reason, to me, Denver feels like a team that, unless they're taking clear advantage of you, they're not willing to go. They're not willing to play. Like, they have had assets on their hands that could have been turned into something better, or something like at least like more draft picks or something. Just, it feels like they've been like in that position forever, and they only make a move when somebody's like, I'm going to give you 2 draft picks for Timothy Mozgov. And they're like, seriously? All right. Like, Denver just feels a little over savvy to me. So, but you could probably, I mean, that's a reasonable deal.
Yeah. I think you've got to me, I don't expect anything big from Dell. I think you've got to try 2 things. One, I think you've got to try to give Ajinsa away and if you've got to attach a player or even one of those second round picks to do it, some team wants Frazier or some team wants Jones or some team wants Galloway or Tyreek, fine. You know, we're not going to even ask anything for you. The asking price is just take Ajinsa off our hands. I think you got to do that. And then the other thing, and this could be part of part one, but if it's not, the other thing is just got to get something, anything from Tyreek Evans, even if it's just a perception thing. But one, just get him off the team so other guys could play. But don't lose another guy this offseason and get nothing for him. Like I said, it might not even be a real thing, just a perception thing, and maybe you get a second round pick and some cash or a guy – some guy who was a second round pick in the last year or two, and you could say, well, hey, we're going to try to develop this guy, but just get anything for Tyreek. I think if you do those 2 things, I would walk away from this trade deadline happy. I don't even care about getting more assets or whatever. Just get those 2 things done. 'Cause in my head, I think Ashik is already going to be stretched next summer. So if I could get Ajinsa gone and then Ashik, I stretch him. And now instead of spending 15 mil on those guys, you're spending 3.5 mil. You know, that just already makes me feel so much better. So those are the 2 things I went done. Do you think that those things are extremely unlikely?
I still feel like in my heart of hearts, they should be trying to move Tyreek, and that maybe they are, but I just don't see them making any moves. I just, for some reason, the way I kind of feel is they know they're in caretaker mode, and unless they're going to get something that will clearly save their job, they're just going to sit there. I really, really believe that. Now, like, and the thing about Tyreek, like, so last year at this point, we were having the conversation about Ryan Anderson. We basically said, Eric Gordon's gone, good riddance, just get him out the door as soon as possible. I don't care, we're not going to be able to trade him because he's always injured and blah, blah, blah. But Ryan Anderson, we were still in the position where we were like, well, you know, if you get something from him, you probably could do it, but you could sign him in the offseason. He'll probably get paid a lot, and it'll be I mean, it won't be the worst thing in the world. And that was a legitimate debate. There were people who were on the side of, hey, keep Ryan Anderson through the year, try to re-sign him in the summer. There are people who are like, no, Anderson's never going to be the answer. Trade him now. But there was like a real debate going on there. People like, there were people on each side. Tyreek Evans, I don't think anybody is on the side of, hey, we should try to keep Tyreek Evans at this point. I think pretty much everybody is just like, when this summer comes around, he should pretty much be gone. So if you can get anything for him, and I don't care what it is, we knew there was some offers on the table for Ryan Anderson last year, and none of them were super appetizing. Like they weren't like knock your socks off awesome, but they were good offers. They were decent offers for him. If there's anything on the table, I don't care if they're offering garbage. As long as they're not increasing your financial obligations, take them. Take him. Is there really any difference, even if you're thinking, I want to win now, is there really that big of a difference between Frazier and Tyreek Evans at this point?
No. I mean, I think Tyreek, you could argue, could have the Brooklyn game where he goes off for 29 and drags you to a win by yourself. So, like, maybe he's more capable of that, where Frazier's probably more steady, but... No, you know, I guess that's the thing I'd want to get into with you is you say that you don't think it matters what their record is over these last six games. I guess I would just hope that you're wrong in that because, all right, right now they're 19-32. They got six games coming up. They got two at home and then four on the road before All-Star break. And then, oh, by the way, when they come back from All-Star break, they got a bit of a murderer's row. So, I mean, to me, if you go 0-6 and you're 19-38 and you're not in full sell mode, like that just would blow my mind. Conversely, if you go 6-0, and all of a sudden you're 25-32 in this crappy Western Conference, you're probably in eighth going into the break. So you're definitely going playoffs and you might not be in buyer's mode, but I doubt you're going to just sell. You don't think that there's any breaking point for that? I mean, do you disagree with me that if they go 0-6, they're 19-38, that would be two losses to the Suns. So they're probably sitting at either the second or third worst record in the NBA. You don't think even with 0-6 over these next six games that they're a definite sell and they're going to move some guys?
I think they should be. I think they won't be. Because I think that this particular management team, they know the writing is on the wall. They know unless they're hitting a home run that's going to propel them to the playoffs this year and they can't walk into Loomis or Benson or whoever they're coming to with these deals for sign-off and saying, this is going to make us an amazing team, they're just going to stay with their heads down. They're not going to make a trade so that the next administration is going to come in and have it easier. I don't see that happening. It sucks. It's awful. I hate that I'm even saying it, but I would be willing to bet that even if they lost every game and even if they lost to Phoenix in embarrassing fashion each time, we pulled Brooklyn Nets losses with those two teams, I think we just see them sit on their hands.
So what are they? I guess I'm trying to figure out what are the conversations looking like? They're 19-38. It's February 16th. There's a week before the trade deadline and there's no games left to be played. They're 19-38. What do you think those conversations are looking like internally? Because the one thing I kind of disagree on is, I mean, obviously they would rather keep their jobs than lose their jobs. But I still do believe that Dell Demps and Danny Ferry, even if they have a feeling they would be fired, would still look at trades and think about what's best in the long. I don't think that they 100 out of 100 times say, yeah, that could really help the franchise out long term, but I'm not going to be here anyway, so F this franchise. Like, I don't, like, I've talked to Dell. You know, one of my best friends worked for Danny Ferry. Like, they're good human beings. I don't think they're that unequivocally selfish, where in every single situation they say, I don't want this franchise to be better 2 years from now. And they're 19 and 38. They would know they're not going to make the playoffs. And even if they do, they're just going to get their butt kicked by the Warriors. Like, I don't know. For some reason, it's just hard for me to believe that they would be that incredibly selfish and self-serving. So what do you think that the conversations look like amongst that staff on the 16th and they're 19 and 38?
I think there are no conversations. I think they're just sitting on their hands. I really honestly believe that. I really think that, like, in order for you to go out and get the best deal, you're going to have to be actively working the trade market. I don't think they're doing that. Now, let's say something falls in their hands. Somebody calls up and says, hey, we really want Tyreke Evans. Please take our first. They're going to do their due diligence and say, yeah, that probably makes sense. Let me go talk to Mickey Loomis and put that in front of him. Sure, maybe that, but they're not going to be sitting there like, all right, we could make this move or move these three pieces and get this guy out here to clear this much room so next year we can have this kind of planning or this kind of financial freedom. I don't think it's going to happen. And it sucks. That's how I think of it. And I also got to think of it in this way too. Mickey Loomis, who's got to sign off on all these things, he looks at this team and they're 19 and 38. And he gets a call. Hey, Dell Demps wants to make a trade. He'd like to come over and talk to you about it, or set up an appointment to go through it. Is he really that likely to listen to what Dell Demps has to say? Like, at that point, isn't he just gonna be like, yeah, whatever? They're gone at the end of the year. I don't care what he wants to do.
Yeah, I see. This is the one area where it's funny to have the shoe on the other foot, because you are way more pessimistic about these people than I am, and I thought I was bad, but I think that's thinking the worst of people, and I think at the end of the day, like I said, Dell Demps, yes, he is self-serving, and he cares obviously more about himself than he does the franchise, as does probably every GM, but I don't think it's that black and white. I still think, you know, he has an eye on doing his job the best. And the job of a general manager is to both think in the now and long term. And, you know, he would do the best for his job. And I think he's going to, even if he's going to lose his job, wouldn't you want to put your best foot forward and show that maybe you're capable in your next job? And if other GMs are talking and, hey, he's not even picking up the phone or doing his due diligence, he's not even doing what's obviously should be done for this team, like, how's he going to get another job? So even if you know you're going to get fired, why wouldn't you at least try to pad your resume as best you can, or, you know, at least appear like you're trying to do those things, which every GM thinks you should be doing right now. And then those people talk and maybe you get a job somewhere else. So, yeah.
It's possible. I like the way that I set myself up here, though. So if they don't do anything, I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't expect them to do anything major. But I think those couple of little things I did are somewhat reasonable. And then I think the other conversation that they would be having to have, if they think they're going to be here long term, you know, and Dell Demps addressed this in a couple of quotes that they did for a story in The Advocate this week of Drew Holiday. Like, I think with the way he's played, and then you look at the landscape and other teams are going to have money and need point guards, I don't think you are walking away this summer. If you have Drew Holiday on your team, he's probably cost you at least $25 million a year. And you've got to make that decision in this next 2 weeks. I think right now, tell me if you think there's a third option. I think the Pelicans' only two options right now, or things that they'll have settled on, is, okay, well, we've talked about it, and we're more than willing, and we're going to go ahead and pay Drew Holiday 25, maybe $28 million a year if it takes, and we're fine with that, and you know, we're going to go for that, or no, we're not willing to do that, and then therefore we should be looking to trade him now and get something. Is there even a third path or a third way of thinking that they could possibly be considering? Isn't it that black?
No, those are the two options.
So if you had to guess.
Unless maybe they're thinking, well, no, because I tried to come up with another option, but no, that's it. I mean, because he's a completely free agent. So it's not restricted. He can make whatever decision he wants. So now it's do I want to go the put all the money on the table route, or do I want to get some small return for him before he goes somewhere?
So if Drew Holiday is a Pelican on February 23rd, then we should take that to mean that this regime, at least right now, is comfortable paying him 25, 26, 27 million a year, right? Or is it possible that they are just dumb and they're thinking, no, we'll re-sign him for 18 to 20 million and we'll keep him, and then it'll get up to 25, 26, and then they'll let him walk?
No, you got to remember what regime we're dealing with. They're probably like, hey, we want to pay him 40 million. they're like he's our guy. We wanna overpay the crap out of this dude.
And
you can say that, and they'll be comfortable paying $25 million or whatever it costs per year to keep him. But our other option that may happen is this regime is perfectly happy to pay him that much. We get to the off season, and before July 1st, they're gone, and there's a new regime that comes in and says, hell no.
Yeah.
And then you just lost him for nothing.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm just talking about this one. And how about you? If I told you that it, July 3rd, I see the future, he signs a 5-year, $125 million deal with the Pelicans, what would you think about that with the way he's been playing lately?
No, I don't want it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be – I think positive he will be making more money than Anthony Davis next year, which is just crazy. But I think that they've got to decide on those. And you're saying you don't think there's any chance that they come to the decision, he's a nice player, we like him, but he's not a $25 million a year guy, and they move him? You don't? Yeah.
Maybe they will come to that decision. But again, I got to flip this. But you're Mickey Loomis, and I'm coming to you and saying, hey, we want to trade the second best player on this team, and we're not going to get much back because he's on the last year of his contract, and maybe I can tell you it's like a tasty morsel that we're getting, but it's not going to be anything amazing. I'm not going to be bringing in another star. Are you going to let me make that decision when you are pretty much sure that you're going to fire me at the end of the year?
Yeah, I guess I just got to ask you then, if you're Mickey Loomis or whoever's calling the shots higher up, then why don't you just, I mean, I know the All-Star Game's in New Orleans and that sucks, but why don't you just fire him on February 16th anyway, and then you have a full week, you know, with whatever it is that you feel like you're going to do next year, you have people working on that, or you just go to Dell and say, you know, what do you think the conversation would be like if Mickey Loomis was like, look, it hasn't worked, we've given you plenty of opportunities, you know, we're going to have to let you go at the end of the year, but I would really like you to execute this over the next week if you possibly can. We're going to do a rebuild in the off season. We're not going to re-sign Drew Holiday for $25 million, so I want you to get the best you can for Drew. I want you to get as many assets for him. Like, do you really think Dell Demps is such a petty guy that
Dell would do that? No, I mean, Dell would execute on that. I just don't know what Mickey's doing. Do you think Mickey's going to be sitting there thinking about what he wants
the Pelicans to execute on, or do you think he's going to be trying to figure out a way to load more dead salary onto the Saints roster?
So that's what I'm saying is, like, we keep talking about Dell and Gentry. Isn't the real problem, if you really believe these things you believe and you're saying, the real problem's higher up then, right?
So I don't even know if these scenarios I'm throwing at you would suck, where I have Mickey Loomis just being, the roadblock. I don't even know if I have a problem. Like if I was just thinking of, if I was running the company I work at right now, and we have this real big problem with one of our projects, and the guy who's running it, and if he keeps coming to me and saying, hey, this thing is now double the budget, and we've been working on it for 8 months longer than we were supposed to, and it still hasn't produced anything usable. Like, at some point, I'm just, like, looking at that guy, and if he says, can I have another $500,000? I'm just going to be like, no, you just roll with what you have while I look for the next option. And if it's going to cost me extra money to get rid of him right now, I'll wait a month and then can his ass. Like, it's not necessarily a bad thing, especially if I don't want to have to get into the weeds myself because I have so many other things to worry about.
Right, but so in your analogy, the one part missing is, don't you know, wouldn't it be beneficial, or wouldn't you have to know as the higher up guy what you want for the future of that project you're talking about to be, what you want its outcome to be? So even if all that's true and Dell is just a dead man walking in Loomis or Benson's eyes or
poor Dell.
I mean, the guy made a good living. He got a chance at a job that very few people have, whatever. Yeah. But shouldn't Benson, Loomis, whoever be at least know, well, yeah, this isn't work, but this is the path that we want to go. And we want to be heading in next year. And if that's the case, I guess what I'm saying is, if they don't know the answer to the question, that's the bigger problem. If they do know the answer and they go, hey, we want to get younger, we're not going to want to pay Drew Holiday, Mike Conley money, yada, yada, yada. We want to put Buddy on the program next year with AD, and we'll just rebuild and get another pit. Like, then all that stuff to me is pretty achievable. And I think the biggest problem would be if they didn't know that, and now they're going to just try to figure that out next year, where they could proactively do some stuff right now. If you really want to be a rebuild team, you could do it really well right now. If you just sell off these parts, I mean, if you get rid of Drew, you get rid of Tyreek, Terrence, whatever, this team is going to bottom out, and then you're also not going to pay. But if you want to keep Drew, then there's that path too, and what you want to be building. I think either way, even if Demps isn't going to be here, it would scare me to death if the people above Demps don't know what they want to be next year, because I think that over these next, 18 days, you could set yourself up better for next year than you could in May, June, and July. This is the time to set it up.
I agree.
And you don't think they're gonna, so.
I've already said what I think. I could be 100% off base. Like, this is how I feel about what I see this team doing. And honestly, you said it before too. Like, don't you think the directive that Tom Benson is saying, win, don't just get winners? Like, anyways.
What I honestly think is going on is, I think that you're right and Dell is a dead man walking, but I think Benson, those people are talking to somebody else that they already have lined up to be the guy to come in next, and that guy would advise them on what path to take, and then Loomis would go to Dell and say, hey, look, I don't think we're comfortable paying Drew that money, and this draft looks really good. I want you to execute this by the deadline. But it's coming from somebody who actually knows basketball, who's going to slide in next year.
You think they're on the phone with Joe Dumars?
On one of his two phones, yeah.
What? One of his two phones. Yeah, I'm sure Joe Dumars' agent would love that to be out there, that they were on the phone with him.
But doesn't that make the most sense? If Dell is a dead man walking with Loomis and Benson,
then
don't think they're talking to somebody else, because they don't know the game of basketball and whatever. They would already be soliciting stuff from somebody else.
That's probably true. Although, you know, we have heard really, really amazing stories about the NBA and how people get picked for GM jobs that are just absolutely insane. And anyways, let's not get negative. Maybe you're right. And maybe, like, somebody awesome is sitting in the wings pulling puppet strings already. Wouldn't that be great? I'd love it.
Yeah. No, let's go for that.
Okay. So let's just rattle off these next games that leading up to the break and pick and make our prediction. Sound good?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so leading up to the break, there's at home Phoenix and Utah, away Minnesota, Sacramento, a back-to-back of Phoenix the night after, and then 2 days later at Memphis to wrap it up before the All-Star break. So it's not exactly murderer's row. It is a road trip in the middle of it that has a back-to-back in the center. What are you thinking? Like, if you had that lineup, who is the most dangerous team there, and who is the most likely win?
I don't see how they beat Utah or at Memphis. I think those are just teams that are tailor-made to hold this Pelicans team to, like, 72 points. Those are the games that I'd be even more shocked if they won those games than I was when they beat Cleveland or San Antonio. So then for me, it comes down to the other four teams. I think they're going to score like crazy against Phoenix tomorrow, and people are going to get optimistic again. And, you know, we see this roller coaster of emotions. I think the game home against Phoenix is the one that I would say is the most likely win. So it's the one I'm going to be rooting for the opponent the most, because I honestly think if they lose that game, it could just be a tailspin right into the All-Star break where they just lose everything. But I think that's the most likely win. And then I also think the game at Minnesota, you know, is when I think if they play this stretch 100 times, the median, the average outcome is 2-4. And those would be the two games they win most often is Phoenix at home and then at Minnesota.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that I think the Sacramento game is just a toss-up. I know it's in Sacramento and it's in the middle of the road trip. I just feel like it's a toss-up. It could go either way pretty easily. So,
Ashik has been the only thing that's able to slow down Cousins in past years, and he ain't playing, so I'll say that.
Well, you know, our team likes to switch, so I think we should just switch and let Drew handle him, because Drew seems to handle bigger people just fine.
Yeah.
Drew is an amazing post defender.
Oh, I agree.
That dude is awesome when you put him on a bigger guy.
He sometimes tries to pull the chair too much, and when the guy doesn't fall for it, it's a really easy dunk. But,
right.
Yeah, no, he's good. Yeah, that Sacramento game, I mean, that just reminded me of another thing I was thinking. Like, if you really want to go all in on selling and tanking, there's a lot of ways to tank, but one way to do it is just start giving some of your decent pieces to teams that are competing with you. Like, why not ship Tyreek to Sacramento and, you know, give Langston Galloway to Minnesota? And, you know, I would very strategically try to place these guys on the teams that have 19 to 20 wins to try to help them pull away from me a little bit. But anyway, that's just a little.
Yeah, Minnesota lost Levine for the season. Maybe they want Galloway.
Yeah, I still don't get how that team is as bad. I mean, Wiggins is a good player. Karl-Anthony Towns is great. I don't get how they're – I did not see them as being the 45-50 win team that a lot of people predicted, but I thought 37 to 40 wins was definitely going to be, you know, the range. I don't know how they're this bad.
Well, I think it all comes down to the fact that People still give coaches way too much credit for how well a team plays or not plays. Because wasn't the idea that they've been one of the worst three defenses every year for the last 3 years, but Thibodeau's there now, and he'll turn them into a good defense?
Yeah.
They're 24th.
Yeah.
They're awful.
No, and that's what I'm saying. Like, people bash Gentry so much. I think there's two coaches that make a difference, Popovich and Carlisle. And, like, I remember when Frank Vogel was a great coach. I remember when Spoelstra was a great coach. I remember when D'Antoni was the worst coach and he was way past his prime. Like, coaches are as good at not just their rosters, but the fit of their system with their roster. And, like, there's two coaches that could transcend their roster in the NBA. I think every coach is basically the same, and, you know, it depends on the situation. So, yeah, people want to say Gentry's terrible. I think a lot of guys are terrible then. I think there's two coaches that matter, and the rest of them are just kind of a victim of circumstance or benefit from their circumstance. But yeah. of the two games that I said I would be shocked if they won, which one do you think they're more likely to win? Home against Utah or at Memphis?
At Memphis. And the only reason why is because it's right before the All-Star break, and that is a veteran team that is just going to be looking forward to taking a break. So you might be able to take them now when they're like, yeah, whatever, we don't care.
Mm.
It's possible. That's the only reason why I said they have a better chance there.
Yeah.
I've seen it before.
What's your thinking for this stretch?
If you set the over under at 2.5, I would have a really, really hard time picking. I'm going to go 3. I think that they take the Sacramento game too.
Wow. Yeah, I think somewhere in the stretch, an injury occurs that helps them lose. I mean, it's been way too long since an injury has happened.
Because Anthony Davis seems to go out every other game. So
yeah, I mean,
maybe they'll finally just be like, yeah, we'll let him sit a couple games.
They're losing at this clip with Drew playing this good. Like, Drew would have to continue to play this good, plus no injuries, Papa, and like, for me, you would need all that to go 3-3. I think 2-4 is the most likely, followed by 1-5 and 0-6, and then we could start
before you go 3-3.
Yeah, because wow. I really think, like, just imagine they lose this Phoenix game Monday, which is possible. I mean, guards destroy the Pelican, and Bledsoe has been playing like a man possessed, and Booker kills us every time. So just imagine they lose this game on Monday, and then they come back and they play Utah, who I just think is tailor made to beat the crap out of them. And then all of a sudden they look up, they've lost 6 in a row. They've, you know, 7 of their last 8. They've got to go on this 4-game road trip before All-Star break. They're tired too. There's all the rumors out there. Like, I could just easily see that snowballing. I think 0-6 is more likely than 3-3, because to go 3-3, you gotta win. You gotta, I think,
win both Phoenix games in either Minnesota or Sacramento.
See, I don't think you win the second Phoenix game because it's the second on a back to back and third in 4 nights. I think you would have to win the Phoenix, Minnesota, and Sacramento games. Which is, I mean, it's doable, but I still think 0-6 is more likely than that. So we shall see.
Okay. Got anything else to talk about? Should we flip roles again and I can come up with something really exciting and you could be depressing?
Oh man, give me a top 3 pick. You want to see optimism? Let's see our draft podcast after it's been announced that the Pelicans got the first or second pick. That's when I'll be optimistic again, because this is a pretty good draft, one of the better ones I've seen in a while.
Make the call. You've got the number 1 pick. Are you taking Fultz or Jackson? Those are my 2.
You would say Jackson just because of small four and you need small four, but yeah. See, this is where you've got to be really brave because I think Fultz could play with Drew and they could be dynamic, but then you've basically got to just bite the bullet and have Buddy as a sixth man. But who would I take between those two? I'd probably take Fultz just because it's very, very, very hard for me to imagine Fultz missing. Where I think if both hit their peak, I can make an argument that Jackson is slightly better and it's obviously a bigger position of need, but it's just so hard for me to imagine Fultz or even Dennis Smith for that matter failing outside of the injuries, of course. But in this guard-dominated league, it's just really hard for me to see either of those guys not being like really, really good.
Okay.
So yeah.
I guess we gotta stop talking about this because I'm gonna just spend too much time on Draft Express if I get too excited.
Well, whatever. I'm gonna start weighing the lottery balls as we speak. So, okay, before you go to bed, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Along Came Polly.
Go watch him Murders and Backboards.
For all of you guys.
Thanks everybody for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back a little later.